Well, thank you. And thank you, David, for inviting me to come out here. It's fun to talk to physicists for a change, because I've been in the medical world for so long. I'm used to talking to MDs. So if at times this seems a little basic and elementary on the physics side, forgive me, and feel free to ask questions as we go along. Also, being in the medical world, we have nice pictures to look at, too. So if nothing else, we've got some nice pictures of brains. We have to move to kind of a different scale now. So the things that you were hearing about this morning and been hearing about a lot, I imagine, in this course are dealing with things at the neuron level. In the humans, we can't look at that level. But we have this remarkable technique for functional magnetic resonance imaging. And so what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about fMRI, how it works, basically how the different techniques work, both from the physics side and from the physiology. Because if you ask someone in the street what MRI is used for, of course, it's not used for functional studies, it's used for anatomical studies. You know, things like this where you get nice high-resolution images of the brain, completely non-invasively. There's no harm that we know of associated with this, although there's a danger of metallic objects flying into the scanner, which, if some of you heard, there was a tragedy not long ago, just a few days ago, where a child was killed in an MR scanner. And it's actually good to bring that up, because people tend to forget, because you walk into the magnet room, it's a very large magnetic field, but the interesting thing is large magnetic fields have very little effect on the human body, so you don't notice anything. Unlike a large electric field, of course, which would cause sparking and things like that, magnetic field you don't even notice. So you tend to forget that it's there, and yet it can exert very large forces on things. So for example, in a standard clinical imager is a 1.5 Tesla magnetic field. That's about 30,000 times stronger than the Earth's magnetic field. It's strong enough that if you have like a 2-pound iron wrench, the force on that wrench into the magnet is about 50 pounds. So it is a strong magnetic field that we're dealing with. And in fact, as we'll see, one of the directions things are going is going toward higher and higher fields. And the main reason is we get better signal to noise at higher fields. So for example, at San Diego, we're about to install a 3 Tesla and a 4 Tesla scanners for human imaging, all to improve the sensitivity for these functional signals that I'll talk about. So what I want to talk about, the way I'd like to do this, and have you been typically taking like one break, two breaks? Break every hour, something like that? Okay. Is first of all, just talk about MRI a little bit, how it works. Because it's interesting physics, and as a physicist working in this field, one of the things that's a lot of fun about the field is that it's a very flexible technique, in that it's not just one thing that you measure. For example, if you're looking at an X-ray image, like a CT image, it's one physical property that you're making an image of. It's the X-ray attenuation coefficient. And that's kind of it. These illustrate some of the flexibility of MR. The signal that we actually measure is sensitive to a number of properties of the tissue. And by just adjusting how we make the image, various timing factors that I'll talk about, you can change the sensitivity to these different physical properties of the tissue. And so you can make very different images. These are three images of the same slice through the brain. The only difference is they're collected in a different way. And you can see there's radically different contrast between one tissue and another. So that what we have is CSF in the ventricles is very bright on this image. White matter is relatively dark. Gray matter is kind of in between. That's reversed over in this one. And this one is sort of in between. So one of the things we'll talk about is why the NMR signal is so flexible. The resolution that we get typically in a human subject is, the best resolution is about 1 cubic millimeter. Okay, it's a very flexible thing. We can adjust that quite a bit. And often, as we'll see, one of the things you're trading off, as in most imaging, as in almost all measurements, is time resolution versus spatial resolution. It takes longer to acquire a high spatial resolution image. You can acquire a low resolution image very quickly. And we use both. This is just an example of a volume data set that's acquired in about 6 minutes. With isotropic resolution, 1 millimeter by 1 by 1. So you can take that data set, it's covering the whole brain, reslice it in any orientation you want to look at different planes. So sagittal plane and a coronal plane there. You can also make the MR signal sensitive to motion. So you can use it to image the blood vessels based just on the fact that the blood is moving. So no contrast agents, not like regular angiography where you inject something, like with a CT, you can do an angiography study like this as well, where you'd inject a contrast agent and then look at the vessel. This is done entirely by the fact that you can make the signal itself sensitive to the velocity. And so what's this is showing is three different planes that you measure, and what you see is the vessels where it cuts through are very bright. You then take that whole data set and project it, and along each ray you pick out just the maximum intensity, and that gives you an angiogram like this. And you can do that at multiple angles and rotate it around. And this is just illustrating sort of the dynamic range, if you like, of time parameters that you could use. So this is that high resolution image that I showed before, about 1 millimeter each voxel volume, sort of the resolved, the volume resolution, is about 1 cubic millimeter, takes about 6 minutes to acquire. This is the same brain, but with a larger volume, 45 cubic millimeters, so coarser resolution. This is like 3.75 by 3.75 by 5, I think, was the voxel volume. But it's collected in 60 milliseconds, so radically different timing parameters. And so this gives us the opportunity to do dynamic imaging, and this is actually what we end up using for functional studies. There's been a couple ways that functional studies can be done. You can use a contrast agent, so then it becomes kind of like a nuclear medicine study. You inject an agent, you watch it pass through the tissue. So this is just showing with dynamic imaging over time, as you look in gray matter, the contrast agent comes in, and this is a contrast agent that stays in the blood, comes in, decreases the signal that you see, and then moves on. Those methods, yeah, sure. The limiting factor in getting faster and higher resolution. Signal to noise and actually physiology. So I'll come to that in a little bit, try to explain that. The signal to noise aspect comes in a very simple way. It's just when you are measuring the signal with a certain resolution, you can think of it as you're measuring a signal from that voxel volume. So you make it smaller, it's a weaker signal. So that comes in as noise and typically averaging, or improvements in your detector capability. But the other interesting thing is that the speed at which we can collect an image is actually not limited by the hardware right now. It's limited by the physiological stimulation. I'll talk about that a little bit. So the technique that lies behind virtually all the fMRI that's done for cognitive science studies or psychiatry studies is based on what's called the blood oxygenation level dependent effect, BOLD. And this is a intrinsic sensitivity of the MR signal, which I'll talk about a lot more as we go along, to the oxygenation of the blood. I think David mentioned that earlier. So as the oxygenation of the blood changes, the signal changes a little bit. And it's only a little bit at a standard 1.5 Tesla imager. It's probably a percent, 1% signal change. So you're constantly fighting systematic errors and signal to noise to try to make a good measurement of that 1% signal change. It grows with higher magnetic field strength. So at 4 Tesla, it'll be several percent, so much easier to measure. So the basic idea of these images, just to give you a little of the flavor first, then we'll go into the details of how it all works. If you were doing an fMRI experiment, the way it would typically be done is you would take a 5-minute block of time, and during that time, the subject would be performing some task. So for example, in this one, they were doing 20 minutes of finger tapping, just thumb to each finger sequentially like that, okay, both hands. Doing that for 20 seconds and then nothing for 20 seconds, and then doing that for 20 seconds and nothing for 20 seconds. So during that time, we collect images. And as you can see, they're rather crude because they are low resolution, but they're collected very fast. So you collect images very fast during that period, maybe as much as 8 or 10 images per second. Then you take that entire data set over time and look at each pixel individually, each voxel's time course. And so this is just a blow up, like some of the figures that I think David was showing down there, of if we take just a 3x3 block of pixels there, this is the time course in each one of these. And these are in these cases, you can see that there is a change in the signal. It goes up here, down here, up here, down here, up here. And there were 8 cycles of finger tapping in this, so we're clearly seeing an activation in the motor area. And the processing then usually amounts to taking each pixel time course, assuming some model response, what you think it should look like if it was responding to that stimulus, doing a correlation between those, and then so you make a map of the correlation coefficient of each pixel with that reference waveform, and then generally threshold that to pick out just the brightest ones. It's usually, the processing can get quite complicated, and there's a lot of arguing in the literature about the statistical techniques that should be used to pull out significant signals. Unfortunately, you can't just do a simple subtraction, which would be the obvious direct approach, is just subtract the signal during the on periods from the signal during the off periods. And it tends to give a lot of artifacts. You tend to get little stuff around the edges and things like that. You have blood vessels, which are pulsing, and tend to have a very large signal change, but it's highly irregular. So it may just randomly show up having a big difference between the on and the off periods, but it's not significant. In other words, by calculating the correlation coefficient, we're essentially calculating the signal to noise at each point. How much variation is there that correlates with the stimulus compared to the overall variance of that signal? And so it's basically kind of a signal-to-noise measurement that's made. And then it's usually displayed by taking a better resolution anatomical image at the same time that you took before you did the activation run, and then just coloring in the pixels that show as activated. So that's what you see when you see these kinds of images. Now, you can get fancier still and combine the fact that you can do high-resolution structural imaging with MR, as well as the activation studies with these fast dynamic images. And this is an example of taking the high-resolution images, the 1 cubic millimeter images, finding the surface of the brain, all graphically, of course, in computer graphics, finding the surface of the brain, inflating it, and then cutting it so that the entire cortex can be laid out flat so you can see where the... And then painted on top of that are the areas that showed activation. So there's a lot of ways in which you can use MRI to get interesting data and display the data in of course, a nifty way. Now, all those things that I was mentioning there are based on blood oxygenation changes. And the problem is, as I'll talk a lot more about as we go along, that's not a simple physiological variable, because the variables you'd like to think of in terms of are blood flow or oxygen metabolism. But the amount of oxygen, or it's really the amount of deoxyhemoglobin that's there, depends on, or the change in that, depends on both the change in blood flow, the change in the oxygen metabolic rate, and the change in blood volume. Because all those things go into affecting how much deoxyhemoglobin is there. So it's not easy to interpret. But MR is such a flexible technique that there's another technique that's a little newer, but it has a lot of promise, that actually is a way of measuring blood flow directly. And it's kind of analogous to nuclear medicine techniques and some of the more classic ways of measuring blood flow. So I'll talk about that. This is just showing, this is an anatomical image. This is a map of blood flow in the brain made with MR. So with that as kind of an introduction, let's go to the basics and talk about physics for a little bit. So just to see how, just show how MR works. Empirically, it's very simple sort of process. Every time you do an MR image, you're basically doing the same classic NMR experiment, which is that you put a sample in a magnetic field, and what happens is that over time, the hydrogen nuclei, which are just a proton, of course, has a magnetic moment, so it tends to align with that field and create a net magnetization. It becomes slightly magnetized because of this. If you apply then an oscillating RF pulse, an oscillating magnetic field, at just the right frequency, it tips over that magnetization, which then begins to process around. And that generates a signal, which decays away over time, but we can measure it before it decays away. Eventually, this relaxes back to looking like that, and we can do the whole thing again. And that's the basic experiment that we keep doing all the time in NMR. And of course, what's happening in that is that the proton has a spin. So it's got a intrinsic angular momentum that you're all familiar with. It also has an intrinsic magnetic dipole moment. And what the source of the precession is, just like anything with angular momentum, if you try to apply a torque to it, you end up rotating things at an angle that's perpendicular to both the existing angular momentum and the torque. You know, just like with a bicycle wheel, you turn it this way and it rotates you this way. So, or a top spinning at an angle, it precesses around the gravitational field. So these spins tend to do the same thing. They will process around. over time, but a very long time, they will tend to align with the field. And that's basically an energy equilibration, so that there will be a tendency, more of a tendency for the alignment to be with the field than opposed to the field. Depending, of course, on KT and that kind of thing, but it's a weak alignment, typically. So in a 1.5 Tesla field, it's only like 1 part in 10 to the 5th, the difference between those aligned with the field and those aligned opposite of the field. And I should say, probably as we go along here, that I'm taking a very classical view of how this works. And the reason is, it's much easier. And you don't need to worry about the quantum view unless you look at spectroscopy and things like that. Essentially, the only quantum phenomenon that you need to understand MRI is the existence of spin itself. So the fact that it has an intrinsic angular momentum. Okay, so the basis of MR imaging is this relationship, that precession frequency is directly proportional to the magnetic field. And that is what we manipulate to do imaging, and it's the source of everything, basically, in NMR. So, so RF excitation. How do we tip over that magnetization? So you put your arm into the magnet. All the protons and the water molecules tend to align with the field. But that does not generate a signal because it's a static magnetic field. If you can tip, but it does create a net magnetization. If you can tip that magnetization over, you're tipping all those spins over and they all precess together and you have a net magnetization that would precess around and eventually relax back, but after many, many millions of precessions. So the way it's tipped over is by applying another magnetic field so that in its frame, so that field, it's again precession. So you have the magnetization is aligned like this. It's aligned with a magnetic field. If you then apply a field that's off like this, it tips the total magnetic field is off slightly at an angle like that. So now the magnetization begins to precess around. If you tip it back just as it precesses halfway around, then so that it goes like that, then it goes around here, comes back, you tip it again, and it goes around there. What you create is this ever-widening spiral, okay? So that the magnetization is tipping around like this and into a much, much wider spiral, and eventually will go completely down in 90 degrees or further around and down to 180 and back up. All because you're applying an oscillating magnetic field, which is causing the total magnetic field to wiggle. And the thing that's fascinating is that you don't need much. You know, the key to this is that you're oscillating this magnetic field at the resonant frequency, the frequency at which those spins will want to precess around. So that the strength of this can be many, many times weaker than this. It is in fact like 1/1000th of the strength of that one. But by doing it steadily, you continue to get an ever widening spiral. So as you tip this magnetization down, you now have essentially a magnet that's spinning around. So if you put a coil near there, there's a changing flux of the magnetic field through the coil, and you pick up a signal, which is called free induction decay. Free because it's free precession, induction because it's inducing a signal in a coil, and decay because it doesn't last forever, it goes away. And the time constant in a perfect solution of water, perfectly uniform magnetic field, is called T2. Now, it turns out that the time constant for the magnetization to relax back to being aligned with the field, so always the equilibrium state is for that magnetization to be pointing along the field. But the time constant for that, which is called T1, is actually about 10 times longer than T2 in the human body. So what that means is once we tip over that magnetization, we generate a signal, that signal decays away in typically less than 100 milliseconds that's gone. But it may take several seconds for the longitudinal magnetization to regrow to its full amplitude. And at that point, you can tip it over again and generate the same signal that you could before. But the interesting thing is that, before I get to that. So the other interesting phenomenon that comes in is echoes. And spin echoes were, I think, first discovered by Hahn while he was a graduate student. Not with this type of a pulse sequence, but with a similar sort of thing. So imagine now that you don't have perfection, that you have a non-uniform field, just random variations in the field. So you have spins at different positions that are actually precessing at different rates. So over time, they get out of phase with each other. And so the net signal from that whole block is going to decay faster than T2. And that faster decay is called T2 star in the jargon of this, and it's always smaller. So for example, if it was a perfectly uniform field, T2 star would be equal to T2. With any reasonable degree of inhomogeneity, T2 star is much shorter and the signal will decay much faster. The clever thing about echoes is that you can actually refocus those inhomogeneities that are due to, you can refocus the phase offsets that are due to inhomogeneities by applying another pulse. And in this case, it's a 180 degree pulse. And what happens is you get this kind of a pattern. The signal decays down to here, you apply another 180 degree pulse, and it comes back up and creates an echo. It's really very dramatic. If you like put it through a speaker, you can hear that the signal is really disappearing and then coming back after another 180. The reason this works, you can see that. This is just illustrating what happens if you tip over the magnetization. Initially, think of it as you have these magnetization vectors sitting in different magnetic fields. Initially, you tip them all over, and then they begin to precess relative to each other. If you imagine just sitting in the average precession rate, then what will happen is they actually fan out over time. Okay? As they fan out, the net signal goes down like that. Signal is decreasing. The effect of a 180 degree pulse applied on that is to flip that plane of magnetization like a pancake. So it just goes chunk over like that. The ones that were over here flip over to there, and over there flip over to there. So what happens is, if you imagine you have magnetization which in the first part precessed this way relative to the average, then you flip it 180 degrees, it continues to precess at the same rate in the same direction and comes back to the center. So if you wait a time TE over 2 and then apply the 180 and then wait TE over 2 again, so you're at time TE, it's come back to being along the place where it started, as have all the other vectors. So you create an echo, and then of course they continue to dephase after that again, but you can apply another 180 and bring them back again. So this is a very critical sort of thing, because it's impossible to build magnets that are perfectly homogeneous, and even if you do, the body is not. So in the head, there are a fair number of inhomogeneities, which we'll see some examples of. But a spin echo can refocus that signal and allow you to make a good, strong measurement. So the basic NMR experiment, which is what we're always doing, is very simple. You have a net magnetization that forms at each, and you can think of this as each voxel in the brain. You have a net magnetization that forms, you tip it over, so that it creates a precessing magnetization, which we then measure. That creates a signal that we measure. That decays away, so the transverse component decays away with a time constant of T2, and the longitudinal component regrows with a time constant of T1. That's all the basic physics of the dynamics of the magnetization that comes into this. And the thing that's amazing is actually it can be quite complex, because you have a couple of time constants here involved, but you also have the frequency as another time constant, and the off resonance of your RF pulse is another one that could come in. So you can actually get some quite complicated effects going on. Yeah?
Could you say a little bit about the origin of the dephasing time T2?
Why it's shorter?
Yeah.
It's essentially coming from fluctuating fields. So if you imagine sitting at one spin and mapping out what the field is over time, it will fluctuate some. And a lot of the fluctuations, in fact, in water, are from the other hydrogen nucleus of the same molecule, of the same water molecule. So if you picture two water molecules that are bound in a nucleus, but that nucleus is then tumbling around, the orientation of this field relative to this field is changing as it tumbles. So it's creating a fluctuating field at the location of that. And because of essentially the difference between T1 and T2 is that the T2 is a dephasing this is your magnetic field. It's a dephasing in this plane. So it's a dephasing due to that Z component there along the field. The key difference is that the fluctuations at zero frequency affect T2, but they don't affect T1. They're both affected by fluctuations in the field at the resonant frequency. But T2 is also affected by just a static offset. It's the same reason that we have T2 star effects, is that a static offset makes things precess at a different rate and get out of phase. So that's there's other frequency components that contribute to T2 than T1. But it's basically these fluctuating components, and that's the reason that a spin echo won't refocus all of those, because the spin echo works by having a fixed phase offset that's accumulated during the first half of the echo and the exact same phase offset accumulated during the second half. So any inhomogeneous field would create that. But a fluctuating field is you know, unrelated in the two halves of the echo, and so it doesn't refocus. So, with this kind of picture of how the magnetization works, how we're manipulating the magnetization, you can begin to see how we get differences in the contrast in the images. When we look at those images, you can think of that as it's a snapshot at a particular time of what that magnetization is, what that transverse magnetization is that we've tipped over. But we can adjust what that time is. So we can tip over the magnetization and measure it very quickly, or we can tip it over and wait a little while. And that is that's called the echo time. So the basic pulse sequence looks like this, that we would give a 90 degree pulse and then a 180 degree pulse. That would create a nice echo, and we measure that echo. The time between the 90 and when we measure the signal is called the echo time, TE. And the time between the 90 and when we repeat the whole thing again, just start over to generate another signal, is called the repetition time, TR. So those are two basic timing parameters that we can just adjust in the machine to do a different pulse sequence. All this is called a pulse sequence with all this. So if, for example, we were to make that TE very short, then the difference between two tissues, one with a short T2 and one with a long T2, is very small. There's no time. Both of them are strong. Neither one has decayed very much, so they're both strong signals. If we wait longer, we get to a point where there's a substantial difference in signal between those, because the one with the short T2, the signal is decayed away more. If we wait too long, both signals are gone. So again, there's no contrast there. So there's an optimal point, which is right around where the T2 that you're trying to see, the T2 of these tissues, where if you make the TE about equal to that, you get good T2 contrast in the image. Alternatively, we can adjust this repetition time, TR. So remember, that's how long it takes after you've tipped over the magnetization for that magnetization to regrow. So if you don't wait very long, then it only regrows part way, and you tip it over, and the signal that you generate the next time is weaker. If you wait a long time, everything relaxes back, and you generate a strong signal that's rather independent of T1. So for a long TR, everything is relaxed, you get a strong signal, but no contrast between one tissue with one T1 and another with a different T1. Whereas with a shorter TR, you bring in T1 contrast. So that's just to give a flavor for the way you can control what the contrast in the image is going to look like, with just based on two of the physical properties, just the two relaxation times, T1 and T2. Another factor that affects the signal, of course, is the water, the proton density, just the content of hydrogen nuclei in the voxel. So a tissue that is very watery, like cerebrospinal fluid, tends to have a higher proton density than white matter, which has a lot of structured components that aren't giving a signal that we're measuring. So that also is a factor of local tissue that comes in. And so by controlling these, how long we wait, we can do these things, these images which are essentially T1 weighted. In T1 weighted meaning that it's the tissues with the shortest T1 that have recovered the most and give the brightest signal. So that would be white matter. CSF is very dark. You can make it density weighted, where you're getting more just the relative densities of things kind of suppressing sensitivity to T1 or T2, or you can make it T2 weighted. There's another type of contrast, to give you a sense of how you can manipulate the magnetization with this, called inversion recovery, where instead of tipping the magnetization over 90 degrees and measuring a signal, you actually start by applying a 180 degree pulse, which flips it all the way down like that. And then you wait a little bit of time, call it inversion time, TI, and then you tip it over 90 degrees. So after you've flipped it, so you take it like this, you flip it down, it actually begins to regrow back up here. You let it regrow for a little while, and then you tip it over 90 degrees to generate a signal, and you measure that signal. It's always the transverse component that you measure, so not that longitudinal component. So the first thing that happens with that 180 degree pulse doesn't generate any signal, it just flips that over. The big advantage of that is you then have relaxation over twice the dynamic range. It's relaxing from minus M0 to plus M0, where M0 is the maximum equilibrium magnetization. And so it gives you an even greater sensitivity to T1, because T1 governs how far along that relaxation curve you've come. It also gives you an interesting flexibility in suppressing the signal from tissues with certain T1s, because at some point, if you wait long enough, that signal is going from a negative magnetization to a positive, so it goes through zero. And so if you apply a 90 degree pulse at that point to look at what the longitudinal magnetization is, it's zero. So you can suppress certain tissues. For example, you could suppress the signal from fat, which also has a lot of protons, by choosing the Ti to be at the null point of fat. This is just an example showing that you can get quite good contrast between gray matter and white matter by manipulating with an inversion recovery type of sequence. And these kinds of sequences are often useful for people who want to segment the brain and need to look at volumes of structures and things like that. You know, especially in different studies of different diseases, there's a lot of interest in looking at the long-term progression in terms of changes in the size of different structures. Okay, so all this has just been about NMR, really, just how you generate an NMR signal. And the trick with MRI, of course, is that we can make an image of that signal. So the way imaging works is that we have to have gradient coils. The RF coils are basically just the signal detectors. That's the coil that's going to be picking up that rotate precessing magnetization. In addition to that, you have to have gradient coils. And the idea of a gradient coil is that it is a set of windings on a coil. This is one that was made by Eric Wong in our group. And the way this would set up, this was actually made to look at the knee, at the extremity imaging. So your leg would go through this. This would be inside here. So it's the RF coil is around there, which is generating these RF pulses that do the tipping and as well as detecting the signal. And then this is what's creating the gradient fields. The idea of a gradient field is it's making, instead of having the field be nice and uniform along a particular axis, you make it very in a nice regular linear way along one axis. So we have three coils, which can make a linear gradient along this axis, or this axis, X, Y, and Z. And so by combining them, you can make a gradient field along any direction. And all it is just creating another magnetic field that adds to the main magnetic field. So if the main magnetic field is like this, then it subtracts on one side and adds on the other to make a nice linear field. And what we're trying to do with that is make use of the fact that the resonant frequency varies with the magnetic field. So we're making it vary in a nice controlled way. So this is just kind of illustrating the basic ideas of the geometry of the magnetic fields that come into this, which is related to the how it relates to the RF coils and to the gradient coils. This is just an example showing if you imagine two rings of current, in one case with the current going in the same direction, in the other case with it going in the opposite direction. When it goes in the same direction, you basically have the beginnings of a solenoidal coil there. It's two turns, you could make it a lot more. And what that produces is a relatively uniform field inside. So that's, of course, what the basic main magnetic field, we want it to be uniform, so we use that. It's also a model for the design of some of the RF coils that are doing the detecting the signal. Because the way, when you have a precessing magnetization, the sensitivity of it, and you have a coil nearby, it'll have a different sensitivity to magnetization at different points and at different orientations. And that magnetization is actually given by the same field pattern that would be produced if you run a current through that coil. So where that coil would produce a large current, it's actually sensitive to a magnetization that's precessing around. So this is a good model also for an RF coil that you want to pick up uniformly the signal from the head, for example. On the other hand, if you want a gradient field, then you can make the currents run in the opposite direction, so the fields tend to cancel at the center, and you get in this central part at least, you get a nice linear gradient field. It has to turn around at some point, you know, so it comes around at the ends. But in this linear portion, you have a nice linear field, which you can see as the kind of steps through there. So those are just to kind of give you a sense of the geometry of the magnetic fields. So with a gradient field, we can do a couple of things. The first thing is that we can limit the excitation pulse that's going to tip over the magnetization to just one slice. So if the resonant frequency is nu zero out here, we can apply a gradient field and then make sure that the RF pulse has a relatively limited bandwidth. Okay, so it has to be on for a little bit of time to have a nice well-defined frequency like that. So it has a well-defined bandwidth, which means that only spins that are within this range here are going to be on resonance. Up here, the resonant frequency at this point is higher because of the gradient field than the pulse that's being applied, and down here it's lower. So if the resonant frequency is off from the resonant frequency locally, it doesn't do much. It wiggles it a little bit, it doesn't tip things over. So you can confine the tipping over to one plane, make a nice clean slice. It can't be perfectly regular, I mean, can't be perfectly sharp, it's got to have a little roundedness to it. But you can basically excite a slice that's, and you can go down to about 2 millimeters of thickness with typical gradients. And then the basic idea of, So doing that has limited the excitation to, say, one plane through the brain, like that. Your coil is still picking up the entire signal from the whole slice. So the way that we separate the signals in there is to apply another gradient when we detect the signal that's running in one of these axes like this. So if we make the field, for example, vary across the slice this way, so it's higher on this side and lower on this side, with that field on, the spins are precessing faster over here and slower over here. So there's a direct correspondence between position and frequency. So all we have to do is take the signal, the net signal from all those that we're getting out, take the Fourier transform, and different frequencies will then correspond to different positions. So just without a gradient, they're all precessing at the same frequency, so in the frequency domain, you don't see this spread in positions like that. You apply a field gradient, now frequency corresponds with position, and so your signal over time is the mixture of these three different frequencies. By measuring that, which is what we can certainly measure from our coil, and taking the Fourier transform, we can get back to the representation of the distribution in position. And that is at the heart of all of MR imaging, that you are effectively, the thing that's tricky, well, actually, I'll come to that in a second. That gets one dimension. You're still getting a projection down to another dimension. There's another technique for manipulating that magnetization called phase encoding, which is actually doing the same thing as frequency encoding to get the other axis. We've got an X, now we need to get Y within the plane. And it's basically looking at, when you're doing frequency encoding, and you're looking at the Fourier transform of that signal during that time period, you can really think of it as being a more discrete process, that you are taking a series of samples at different times, and at each sample, things have precessed a little bit, and so you're getting a different mixture of the net signal is a different mixture of precessions of the individual signals. You could get the exact same signals by imagining breaking this gradient into a series of pulses, so that there's a pulse on here. While that's on, the field is like this. Things precess a little differently here and here, and then you turn it off again. They're back at the same frequency, but you've locked in some phase changes due to that time that they were on. So the net signal that you get is still the same at each of those points. You could then imagine simply doing these one at a time. You could apply a single pulse and measure a signal. The next time you could apply another gradient pulse, but make it twice as strong. Instead of making the gradient like this, you make it like this, so that now the spins over here are precessing twice as fast relative to the spins over here as they were before. So kept on for the same time, you develop twice the phase change. So this series of ways of breaking up, applying this gradient, gives you equivalent signals to what you're getting up here. And the tricky thing with MRI is that you can do these simultaneously with a gradient along one axis to do phase encoding and a gradient along a perpendicular axis to do the phase encoding. So frequency encoding and phase encoding. By doing that, you end up with a basic pulse sequence that looks like this, where you are applying an RF pulse to generate a signal and then gradients along three different axes to encode that signal, the position of where that signal is coming from. And so in this case, it's got a frequency encoding along X where the signal is collected. We have a gradient on here. We step through different values of gradient here along Y. So each time you repeat that pulse sequence, you use a different value of gradient there. And on Z is a slice selection pulse, so that when that RF pulse is applied, it excites only one slice. From that data, then, you can put together an image by taking the Fourier transform. And the tricky thing about this is that you think of an image as a certain, you know, a matrix of signal intensities. We aren't measuring those intensities directly. What we're actually measuring is the Fourier transform of that image. And that we're measuring very directly, so that this signal that we're measuring is directly the Fourier transform of the distribution in space of the sources there. So we're effectively measuring different lines in what's called this K space, or the k for spatial frequency. So that if we imagine that your image looks like this, just a square in the center of the image, it has a certain Fourier transform, spatial Fourier transform that looks like this. As we're doing imaging, we're essentially just measuring one line at a time. Each time we run through that pulse sequence, we measure this line of data. Each phase encoding step then moves it to a new line, and we measure another line through that. And then when it's done, when we've collected that full matrix over there, we take the Fourier transform and we get back to the image over there. So it's really Fourier imaging in that we're working in the imaging plane. And a little more mathematically, you can see that if you're what the effect of a gradient is. The gradient is a difference in resonant frequency per position times the position is giving you what the resonant frequency is at a certain point. That times the diamagnetic ratio tells you times time tells you what a phase angle is as a function of position and time. And then the net signal is simply adding up a density function and position with that phase angle. It's a complex signal that we're measuring. The trick is, if you imagine then you could write this as e to the ik of tx, okay, just by letting k equal that. But this is just the definition of a Fourier transform. Okay, so the tricky thing is that we are sampling this k-space with this gradient, and by adjusting how we turn on these gradients and how we manipulate them in time, we're actually defining a trajectory through k-space that lets us do the imaging. Yes? Sorry, at the middle of the
field. The
field is unchanged from the main magnetic field of the magnet. Right. So the picture that we have that we use in imaging is that the image plane looks like perhaps that. The k-space plane, you know, your eye can't see the structure in there that's there, but that's typically what it looks like. And each point, you know, because this is the Fourier domain, each point in here really corresponds to a wave pattern across the entire image. So this is just amplifying that point, for example, or that point up there. As you get farther from the center of k-space, so this one is out a little farther, the frequency, the period over here becomes shorter, okay? And the angle of the pattern that this is describing is related to the angle in k-space over here. So the task of imaging is simply to measure this k-space out to a certain point, out to a certain value, and how far out you go determines what the resolution of the image is going to be. Because if you don't go very far out, for example, if you're only measuring here, you're only measuring the lowest spatial frequencies. You're zeroing out, effectively, the high spatial frequencies, and it's the high spatial frequencies that give you resolution. So this is what you get, for example, if you take a full matrix that looks like this, out to this far, gives a nice high-resolution image. If you chop that down and only take this part here, you get a blurred version, but some of you maybe, I don't know how good the projection is, but it's not that bad, actually, remarkably, considering it's like 1/16th the data that goes into this. But it's definitely blurred compared to that one. And of course, if you get down to a very little bit of data, it's substantially blurred. So these are the kind of trade-offs that we have to deal with. When we want to measure a high-resolution image, you have to cover a lot of k-space. There's a lot of points that you have to measure, you know, a lot of data points that you physically have to measure. Well, then you get then you've cut out the low frequencies. So you could do that. There are various tricks that have been proposed. Actually, there's one that's kind of the opposite of that, for doing high rapid imaging. People have proposed doing a high resolution image like this, but then basically just updating the central regions over time very quickly, using the same ones, the high frequency components that were measured earlier. And of course, all that really does is give you a low resolution dynamic image. But you were supplying, in a sense, it's helpful, because you can imagine if you were to measure only that much data, you were effectively making these zero out here. And that's a poor guess as to what these values should be. So if you had some information to provide for that, it's probably going to be a little better. So there's a lot of tricks you can try to play with how you actually sample through that k-space. And in fact, there are various trajectories you can use with different acquisition techniques that go through that. So the kind of conventional one that I showed the diagram before earlier really just does one line at a time. And you have to repeat the pulse sequence and collect another line and keep doing that until you get the full image. You can combine collect several lines with what's called a fast spin echo or a turbo spin echo sequence, where you use multiple 180 degree pulses to generate echoes, and you encode each echo differently. So each echo is giving you one more line. You can do echoplanar imaging, which is probably the standard imaging technique for fMRI, which with a single shot, a single excitation, scans back and forth across the plane until you've covered the whole thing. So what's kind of limiting us here is there's only so fast you can go in scanning through the K-space plane. So if you need to cover a large volume of K-space, it just takes more time. So EPI images are some of the ones I showed you earlier, tend to be lower resolution. There's another trajectory, which is actually a very nice one, although it's not standardly used, is a spiral, which starts in the center and comes out like that. Both EPI and spiral can be either a single shot acquisition where it's one excitation and then you measure the data all through K-space, or you can do a few multiple shots where you would perhaps scan through again but with catching the in-between lines in here to expand it out, or going to higher K-space values.
But if the image is changing in the special position, well, this is for special resolution.
Right. Well, this is typically done in about, say, 50 milliseconds. You can cover that for a low-resolution EPI image. So that's very good for most of the problems you usually have with MRI imaging. The problems you tend to have are people move. You know, so if you have a 5-minute acquisition, someone coughs in the middle, it can create artifacts because some of your Fourier data is not consistent with other Fourier data, and so it leads to ghosting and things like that. One of the applications of EPI in these single-shot techniques is to try to freeze things, at least physiologically, for the cardiac motions and that kind of stuff. So you can freeze those. What limits it?
Yeah.
Good question. Let me come to that in just one minute. This is just showing good high-resolution images. So let me come to the echoplanar sequence, because that is kind of the standard one that we use most of the time for fMRI studies, and talk about what it is that actually limits things. So with an echoplanar sequence, we're scanning back and forth. Remember, it's that kind of back and forth motion across K-space. And the way that's done is that you have, you excite a signal over here, you apply a couple of gradients here, but then the basic module that you repeat 32 times to get a 64 by 64 image has a gradient that is basically oscillating, so along x. It's plus, then it switches down to minus, then it comes back up. You have these little blips in between that are moving into different lines. So what this corresponds to in K-space is that, so this is a diagram showing the gradient waveforms over here and how you're actually scanning through K-space. So the first two lobes here are negative lobes, take you from here down to here, and then you start back across here. The spacing of the dots is representing equal time intervals. So it takes some time, you basically slow down here and turn around. And then you come back across here, you come across here and turn around again, takes some time, and you come back across here. This turning around over here is on these ramps. That's where you're switching back and forth. So this positive one would be the scanning across here, the negative one would be scanning back across there, and so on. So you can think of this in, it's kind of like driving a car on a racetrack. You have two things that might limit how fast you can go. One is how fast you can go on the straightaways, and the second is how fast you can corner, how fast you can turn around. How fast you can go on the straightaway is set by the gradient strength. So if the gradient is stronger, you can move faster across here. But the limiting factor is this turning around. Because that's where you have to actually switch a magnetic field. You've got a magnetic field which is stronger over here. The gradient looks like this. You're trying to switch it to this. So you really are changing the magnetic field. And in particular, at the end of the gradient coil, there really is a fairly large dBdt. And the problem is, not with the hardware, because you can make hardware that switches very fast, but that large switching magnetic field can actually stimulate your nerves. And so you can get twitching, or what you worry about is, something that's going to affect your cardiac rhythms and things like that. So we are limited in doing humans to having dBdt levels that are sufficiently low that we're below the limits of creating an actual stimulus in the nerves. And so that actually is what limits a lot of the fast acquisitions, because for a fast acquisition like this, you're more limited by these turnaround points than you are by how fast you can go across here. So there's a couple, for that reason, the way things are going to go, are continuing to move toward getting faster acquisitions are, one is how bad the BDT problem is depends on how big your coil is. You know, if your coil is this long and you have a gradient like this, then that gives this level of dBdt change at each end. If the coil is shorter, then the same gradient switching back and forth could be produced with a much smaller dBdt. So one approach is to try to make local gradient coils, make gradient coils that are very small in space, and it cuts down on the total field of view you're imaging, but you can image with much higher performance on a smaller region. So for example, we have a head coil that Eric Wong designed that is deliberately made as short as possible to try to get the brain. And unfortunately, that kind of meant cutting out the cerebellum, in that the cerebellum is in a distorted part of the field, and so it doesn't usually work too well. But the rest of the brain works great, because you can have very strong gradients, you can switch them fast, and the DBDT problems are not significant. The other approach that you can use to speeding things up is a clever one that's just starting to come in now, which is to use multiple receiver coils. So earlier I was talking about having like one coil that's receiving the signal from the entire head. You can also imagine putting several smaller coils around the head. And the trick is you have to have a separate receiver channel for each one of those. So you basically have four receivers instead of one with say four coils around the head. And that actually has a couple of advantages. One is small coils close to the head have better signal to noise than a large coil. A large coil is picking up noise from everywhere. Small coil is more focused on the spot. But the other thing is that those coils will have different spatial sensitivities. And so you can use the signals coming from those different coils as kind of a way of letting you not measure all of K-space. So you don't necessarily have to sample this as regularly as you would, because you have some spatial information in what the response is to this coil compared to that coil compared to this coil compared to that coil. And so by cleverly designing those things, you can actually cut your imaging time down by a factor of two or even more. So the improvements in speed are coming more from clever things like that, clever designs of RF coils and clever designs of gradient coils, rather than driving these faster. Should we take a, well, actually, give me, this almost at a point for a break. In fact, let's, yeah. So back again, just to the picture of the flexibility of MR, we can take everything from very high resolution images to very fast images. But all we've been talking about so far is anatomy. Just that intrinsic MR signal and how we use that to get anatomy. So the next step is, why should that ever be sensitive to the function? And that's what we'll talk about next. So why don't we take a break for 10 minutes, 15 minutes? Back at 3:20. We can start going again. And now I wanted to turn now to the question of how do we see function with this. Now that you understand how MRI imaging works, what makes it sensitive to the functional state of the tissue and not just to the anatomy. And the idea actually goes way back. This was in William James' Principles of Psychology. He describes an experiment that was tried. It's hard to believe it ever worked. It's described as a subject to be observed lay on a delicately balanced table, which could tip downwards either at the head or the foot if the weight of either end were increased. The moment emotional or intellectual activity began in the subject, down went the balance of the head end in consequence of the redistribution of blood in his system. So that's still the way we do it, just not quite with the same technology. But we're still looking at the redistribution of blood. And, you know, at that point, this was all mostly speculation as far as how localized the flow changes could be and that kind of thing. But what we know now is that it really does work that way, that the blood rushes very much to each part of the cortex as it's active. But as you'll see as we go along, it's not at all clear in a quantitative way what's going on with all this. And that's partly the big
question that underlies all of fMRI is that it's a very widely used technique. We really don't understand the physiology of what's going on with that very well. The basic idea, though, of this is that we aren't looking directly at neural activity. We're looking at the metabolic activity that must follow from that. So neural activity is related to having things far from equilibrium. You've got ions that are far out of equilibrium because they're separated by a membrane. And the action that goes on in creating an action potential and in neuronal signaling is basically downhill reactions. The neurotransmitter is already packaged tightly so that once it's released into the synaptic cleft, it's just a diffusion process for it to go out. The ions are separated already by membranes by changing permeabilities. Things go in a downhill fashion. So things are designed so that the neural signaling is all downhill. But to reestablish those gradients, repackage the neurotransmitter, and get back to the same point is an uphill process. So that's where we need the energy metabolism. And in the body, all of these, virtually all of these things are connected either directly or indirectly to ATP. And when it's indirectly, what I mean is that often ATP is used to create a gradient, so an ionic gradient, and then various processes that need free energy are coupled to that gradient, as to degradation of that gradient. So this is just one of the pictures of how energy metabolism might be working. This is from Magistretti et al., which is the idea that actually energy metabolism may involve very strongly the astrocytes. You know, we tend to think of mainly the neurons as the active elements in here. The energy metabolism picture has a very active role for astrocytes, with the picture being that because the recycling of the neurotransmitter here is through the astrocytes. The glutamate is taken up, converted into glutamine, and then delivered back into the presynaptic terminal over there. And all these processes require ATP to pull these things out. Astrocytes tend to be situated very close to the capillaries, so they're in good position to pull up the glucose. And the idea that Magistretti has been promoting is that the astrocytes primarily use glycolysis for this, that they pull in glucose, they partially metabolize it to lactate, and then feed that lactate to the neurons later on. It's one picture just to show you what kind of how the energy metabolism may work with this. But the basic picture of the brain energy metabolism, as you probably know, is that it gets nearly all the energy it needs from glucose and oxygen. If you metabolize glucose, you can go partway without oxygen in glycolysis, and it generates a few ADP. You can generate 2 ADP and some lactate. If the pyruvate that's formed at the end here goes into the TCA cycle, you can generate quite a bit more ATP. So oxidative metabolism, but it requires oxygen. So oxidative metabolism generates lots of ATP, but there's reasons that you may want to, that in different parts of the brain, you may want to get a good part of the energy from glycolysis, because it's actually faster. You can get to this energy much quicker through glycolysis than you can through this. So the basic picture then of energy metabolism in the brain is that glucose and oxygen have to be delivered by blood flow. They have to get into the brain and metabolized. CO2 is produced, is carried away by blood flow. Water is also produced, and heat is produced. They all have to be carried away. And so we have this basic picture then of metabolism as glucose coming in, glycolysis happening in the cytoplasm itself, and then the pyruvate having to go into the mitochondria, and in the mitochondria is where you have the oxygen metabolism that goes on. So what I'm going to do is just review a little bit about some of the techniques that have been used to measure these metabolic changes associated with activity as a way of leading up to the fMRI stuff. One of the classic ones is the deoxyglucose technique, which is to directly measure glucose metabolism. And it uses a form of glucose in which you modify the molecule so it can go partly down the metabolic path through this step to glucose-6-phosphate. But then it stops because it's deoxyglucose instead of glucose, it can't combine with the enzyme to do the next step, so it just sticks. Now, the clever thing about that is that it lets you have a concentration over time of deoxyglucose that might look like this. You inject it, it comes in, some of it goes into the brain, some of it's metabolized and some of it's not. But what's not metabolized comes back out into the blood and disappears. But after, over time, you're left with just the deoxyglucose that sticks, that went down through this part of the metabolic pathway. That means that there's a time point out here when the deoxyglucose concentration actually is a very direct measure of the glucose metabolic rate. So by attaching a radioactive label with carbon-14 to the deoxyglucose, you can inject it, wait till you get out here to this plateau, and then for animal studies, sacrifice the animal, and through an autoradiographic technique, make an image of where that carbon-14 is as a direct measure of what the glucose metabolic rate is there. And that, of course, has been a very successful technique in animal studies. It gives you ways of looking at this is an early study from Kennedy and Sokolov's group and all, looking, I think it's eyes open, eyes closed, and one eye open, so you can directly see some of the columnar organization of things that would have taken, of course, a lot more work to do it with individual electrodes, so you're getting it all at once by looking at the oxygen, at the glucose metabolism. There's a version then that can be used in humans with positron tomography. You can't do carbon-14 and autoradiography in humans, of course, but with positron emission tomography, you can do humans, and there are the version of that is a fluorinated version of deoxyglucose, because fluorine-18 is a radioactive nucleus that gives off a positron, and the way positron emission tomography works is fairly simple. It's essentially that you've got a nucleus that's going to give off a positron. Positron won't last long before annihilating with an electron. The annihilation products are then two gamma rays with well-defined energies corresponding to the rest mass of these two that come off in opposite directions, or virtually opposite directions. There could be a little bit of difference depending on the energy of the positron and electron when they combine. The advantage of that is that when you're trying to do a measure from outside, so you imagine you have detectors out here and you're trying to measure the signal from a radioactive nucleus inside here, it's hard to tell where that's coming from. And you have to have big collimators that are limiting your field, your sensitivity to a very narrow channel so that you can see where these signals are coming from. With a PET technique, you have an automatic collimation, because in order for to detect this, it really should be, it will create two coincidence detections within a very narrow time window. You should be detecting a photon here and there, the one that's going in that direction, as opposed to scattered photons and all that kind of thing. So it gives you a very, very direct way of making a more quantitative measurement of the local concentration of an agent than you can get with other sort of nuclear medicine techniques. That's just a brief aside on PET stuff. So glucose metabolism is certainly something that can be measured. It can be measured in humans with FDG, and certainly in animal studies with EG. And there's always, so in numerous studies, people have found a close correspondence between the glucose metabolism changes and the neural activity. So in studies where you know what part of the brain you're activating, you see a glucose metabolism change that can be quite substantial, on the order of 50% or so. Now, to measure blood flow, this is just a picture giving you a sense of how complicated looking the vasculature in the brain actually is, and David probably showed you some pictures earlier as well. But you can look at it on multiple spatial scales. You know, this is an MR angiogram showing kind of the large vessels in a human brain. This is a cast of a human brain showing the capillary mesh. It's very twisted and kind of convoluted sort of structure. It's not at all the simple cylinders that we tend to model them as. And of course, one of the things that's interesting is that the capillary density and this local capillary vasculature varies on a small spatial scale, even among different layers in the brain. This is from a monkey brain. But the shadings here are meant to represent sort of the capillary density. And you can see it's higher in some parts and lower in other parts. So clearly, tightly coupled in development to the level of activity that's going on in a certain area, as you would expect, because it's delivering the key ingredients that you need to fuel the brain. Now, talking about blood flow gets a little, there's some subtleties that I just wanted to go through quickly, because you see in different publications discussions of these things, which sometimes in an interchangeable way when they shouldn't be. The idea is that there are several parameters that you could use, to physical parameters you could use to describe blood flow through a region. There's blood flow, there's blood volume, there's blood velocity, and all those are clearly interrelated in some way, but it's a little subtle how they are. So the way blood flow is actually defined, sort of the meaningful definition of blood flow, is you add up all of the arterial inputs, so the mLs per minute of arterial blood that are passing through a capillary bed in a local region of tissue. That's the actual flow that we're interested in, because that's the flow that's delivering nutrients and carrying away CO2. Now, what complicates it is you might have, for example, in this case, here's a larger vessel with a couple of smaller arteries shooting off. There's blood right in here, which is not destined for a capillary bed here. It's destined for a capillary bed somewhere else. So that blood, that flow in there is not really part of the real cerebral blood flow that we're interested in. Similarly, there's blood moving in veins over here. So you have veins draining perhaps another region, which will be present in this voxel, in this local volume, but again are not something that we're interested in. So it's good to keep these in mind, because there's no simple direct way for measuring blood flow. It's always techniques that are related to other things, the motion of the blood or something like that. And it's important to realize that these things, sometimes what's being measured is not really the flow that we're interested in. The other tricky thing is that it seems like if you knew the velocity of the blood and you knew the volume of blood that was moving, that you ought to know the flow. But in fact, you don't. And so this is an example where, imagine we have two capillary beds here, which are constructed so that this volume here plus that volume up there is equal to this volume here. So they have the same volume of blood. Oh, sorry. I think I'm so we have two capillary beds here, which are constructed to have the same blood volume and the same velocity moving through that. And yet the flow is twice as high. What we would call cerebral blood flow in a meaningful way is twice as high in this one than in this one, because that's the arterial input that's coming in. So this is a little tricky. It gets a little subtle. And some of the techniques, like even some of the standard techniques, like laser Doppler or flowmetry, are really looking at how much blood is moving around. And for that reason, they really don't give an absolute measure of blood flow. Partly because of this, it turns out that it's actually hard to measure blood flow by actually looking at the blood in a voxel. What you're really interested in is how much is being delivered, not how much is there. Okay? It's because it's the arterial delivery that governs whether you're delivering glucose and oxygen, that kind of thing. So the techniques that are the best for looking at blood flow are techniques which involve some agent that you introduce into the system and is delivered to the voxel of interest, and then you're measuring how much is delivered directly. The first measurements that were made goes all the way back to 1948, just after the war. Ketty and Schmidt developed a technique for looking at the whole brain blood flow. And the idea is really very simple. They use nitrous oxide. And the idea is, if imagine you have a tank here that you're putting ink in, or dye over here, and allowing it to mix in here, and then it flows out. Eventually, if you were to plot the concentration in the tank and in the outflow, eventually these concentrations would all come up to the same level. After you've delivered enough dye, it would all be colored to the same level, and it would be a constant concentration. At the point that it's all equal, you have no information on flow, but the flow affects how quickly you get to that. If your inflow is very high, you will quickly come to a steady state where it's all the same. If your flow is low, it'll take longer. So the technique that they used was to introduce nitrous oxide, and measure the concentration in an artery and a vein, like carotid artery and jugular vein, over time, and map out these kind of curves. And then by modeling this, you can tell essentially knowing what the volume of the brain is, you can tell what the total flow to the brain is. So it seems like a very crude sort of technique, but it was immensely powerful, because it actually gave a way of measuring the total blood flow to the brain under a number of different states. And so there were immediately lots of papers followed from that, looking at effects of different respiratory gases, you know, CO2 and oxygen, as well as even some activation studies, although you can imagine you have to be pretty big activations to get a measurable change in the entire flow to the brain. So the difficulty that they had to deal with in those early days was what they could measure was the inflow and the outflow. Those were the two concentrations that they had access to. What tomographic imaging allows us to do is measure this in here. And that allows us to go then to a much smaller volume. You can imagine doing the same kind of experiment
if you could somehow sample a local vein that was a small vein that was draining a small part of the brain, you could apply this same reasoning to that small part. But you can't do that, of course, in human very easily to find that vein. But with imaging and allowing us to measure this concentration here, we can do it at every voxel in the image, the same kind of thing. So nearly all of the good blood flow techniques that are around measure the delivery of some substance to the local capillary. To the local capillary bed. Sort of the gold standard for a blood flow measurement is microspheres. That is, it's a sphere that's too big to fit through the capillary bed. So it goes all the way down to it, but then sticks. And then, so you can imagine you inject a certain number of microspheres, wait for them to distribute, and then simply count how many there are at each location in the brain, and you get a direct measure of what the blood flow is there. So that's, again, something that we can't do in humans, because it blocks up the capillaries, but it's done in animal studies and is considered the gold standard for measuring blood flow. But we can do some of the agents that we can use are almost like that, in a sense. And in fact, what I want to show for the MR techniques that we use, it's virtually like that, because what we are using is labeled water, which goes into the, reaches the capillaries, and most of the water in the capillary, blood, actually leaves the capillaries during a transit, so it gets into the rest of the brain. And so during the time of our experiment, behaves a lot like a microsphere. It basically hasn't had time, as we won't give it time to clear out, so it sticks in there. So just to think about what happens with an agent, imagine that you inject some agent and it takes, and over time, so that the arterial concentration is held at some high level like that. Over time, the concentration approaches some value, plateau value out here, when the blood within the space is completely filled, or when the space that the agent goes to is completely filled. So there's basically two different types of agent that we deal with in these kinds of studies, intravascular tracers and diffusible tracers. The idea is that an intravascular tracer stays in the blood, a diffusible tracer gets out of the blood and fills the entire tissue. And the description, the physical parameter that describes this is what's called the volume of distribution, lambda. So the volume, it's really the fractional volume that the agent can get to. So for water, for example, the fractional volume is 1, it can get everywhere, basically. Whereas a diffusible tracer, like something which is bound to albumin or something that's just too large to cross the blood-brain barrier, stays in the blood. The trick with these things is that if you were to imagine keep putting the arterial concentration at a constant value and then watching the tissue concentration change, once you reach a plateau, you're very sensitive to what that volume of distribution is. So if it's an intravascular agent, you can measure the blood volume very readily from that point. But at this point, once you reach that plateau, you're no longer sensitive to flow, because flow only affects the approach to that equilibrium and the approach back down to rest after the arterial concentration drops. So you have this region in here when you can measure flow, and this region in here when you can measure the volume of distribution. So for that reason, one of the seemingly paradoxical things is it's very hard to measure flow with an agent that stays in the blood. And that's because it fills a very small volume fraction of the tissue, and so fills very quickly. So this time period in here where you are sensitive to the flow is very short and harder to measure. A better way to measure flow is with an agent that is diffusible, gets all the way out into the tissue, because then it takes a long time to fill that space, and that dynamic portion is when you're sensitive to the flow. Okay, that's just a little bit about the background on those things. And for many years, the classic way of doing that was with PET, using a diffusible agent, which was water labeled with oxygen-15, has about a 2-minute half-life. And so you would inject, typically, or there were ways of doing an inhalation of another compound that would convert to water, and then make images, and you could get things that look like that. Now, it turns out, with MRI, we can do a technique that's actually very similar in principle to the PET techniques, but we are not having to actually inject any labeled compound. We can label the water magnetically, and I'll come to that in a minute. Okay, so with all these techniques, there are a lot of PET techniques for measuring blood flow, for measuring glucose metabolism. It seemed to be a nice simple picture. We have synaptic activity, increases ATP consumption, various agents lead to changes in blood flow, trigger changes in blood flow, which supplies the substrate you need for energy metabolism. And when combined measurements were made of CBF and glucose, they seemed to go up about the same amount. Fairly large changes, 30%, 50% with PET. And so this picture of a close coupling of metabolism and blood flow was seemed very straightforward. Now, it turns out that measuring oxygen metabolism is harder to do with PET, or with anything for that matter. It's one of the difficulties. It's not easy to measure oxygen metabolism. And so with PET, it actually requires three different isotopes to measure blood flow, blood volume, and make corrections for that. So when Fox and Raichel finally came to do a careful study of measuring CMR2 in conjunction with changes in blood flow and glucose metabolism in the late 80s, they discovered something very surprising, which was that the oxygen metabolism did not go up as high as either the glucose metabolism or the blood flow. So that where they were finding a CBF change of 30% with a particular activation, this was only going up 5%. And so the sort of paradoxical result of that is that the oxygen extraction fraction, the fraction of the oxygen that's delivered, that's actually removed and metabolized, actually decreases with activation, opposite to what you would perhaps naively expect. That picture was rather controversial for a while when it was just the PET literature that was discussing it, because there was a lot of real and implied criticism of the techniques that led to that, because it didn't seem like it could be like it was plausible. But this kind of a picture, that the extraction fraction goes down, has a very important consequence for MR, and that's where we get to functional MRI, and that is that the local deoxyhemoglobin content actually decreases with activity. So we have oxyhemoglobin and deoxyhemoglobin. If there's less oxygen removed, there will be less deoxyhemoglobin with activity. So deoxyhemoglobin goes down. And that's important now to MR. When we go back to the physics, imagine that because of the magnetic susceptibility effects that it has. So magnetic susceptibility is just a measure of how magnetized something becomes when you put it in a magnetic field. So if you put your arm in a magnetic field, it will become partly magnetized. The protons aligning with the proton magnetic moments aligning with the field is what we use for NMR, but that's actually a small part of the susceptibility. It's more the electrons, the unpaired electrons, or diamagnetic sort of molecular orbital kind of motions that tend to align. But whenever you have two materials with different susceptibilities and you put them in a uniform magnetic field, it creates field gradients outside. So for example, a sphere of one susceptibility inside and different susceptibility outside creates a dipole field like this through all space. And if in MR imaging, field distortions were only interested in one component of that. Because remember, what we've got is we've got this huge magnetic field that we're sitting in, and then there's this dipole field that's added onto that. Components that are perpendicular, only components that are parallel to that will have any significant change in things. So it's the Z component that we need, and that has a picture like this. So this is sort of a classic picture of what the Z component looks like, this lobed thing like that. And it's a little different for a sphere or a cylinder, but the basic idea is if you have the susceptibility of one material is different from another, you can have these field gradients, and that happens because of deoxyhemoglobin. Deoxyhemoglobin is paramagnetic, but oxyhemoglobin is diamagnetic. So the more deoxyhemoglobin that's present, the more the susceptibility of the blood inside is changed relative to the outside. And that creates these little field gradients around the capillaries. So here's for example, a model of a vessel. This is actually MR images. One of the nifty things about MR imaging is that we're really measuring a vector. So, we talked about measuring that transverse magnetization. And most of the images you will see are giving an image of the magnitude of that vector. But we can measure the phase as well. It's part of that Fourier transform process gives us the phase as well as the magnitude. It's just typically not shown. But if we make an image of that phase, we actually have a way of mapping out what the magnetic field distortions look like on a large scale that we're imaging. Because if you imagine tipping over magnetization and letting it process for a little bit and then making essentially a snapshot of what that vector looks like, if it's in a higher field, it'll process faster. If it's in a lower field, it'll process slower. So you get a phase difference that depends on the field. So by plotting that phase, you get maps that look like this, which are direct measures of the magnetic field distortions in the brain. So what you can see is that in this human brain here, we have a sinus cavity here where there's air, we have the brain, which is water, and we have various bony structures, all of which have different magnetic susceptibilities. And the dominant thing is kind of a dipole pattern, which you can kind of see centered on the sinus cavity here, but extending through the whole brain. In a simpler sort of geometry, as two concentric cylinders with different materials inside and outside, you get a nice simple pattern just like the theoretical patterns there. So, the interesting situation we're in then is that deoxyhemoglobin, so picture this now as a capillary or a small, really more like a small vein where there's more deoxyhemoglobin. It creates these distortions around it. Our imaging voxel is huge compared to this. So we're measuring signals from this whole area in here. But each where there's a field offset, it means there's a precession frequency offset. So they aren't precessing together, and the signal tends to decrease. So the more deoxyhemoglobin that's present, the lower the signal should go. So what happens with activation then is that deoxyhemoglobin, there's less deoxyhemoglobin, so the signal actually goes up. It's a small change. If you were to plot the signal, and if you can see, there's two lines here. This is an activated state and a not activated state of a voxel. And those lines are very slightly different. The T2 stars, the relaxation time for these curves, is different by 48 milliseconds compared to 50 milliseconds. So it's a very small change. But we can measure that. That's what I mentioned earlier was this change that's on the order of 1% of the signal. But it is enough to measure. And so this is just another example showing a data very much like the other one where we can map out the time courses of these different pixels over here, and we see ones that are strongly correlated with the stimulus. This was a 4-cycle of finger tapping in there because the deoxyhemoglobin is oscillating during those periods. Now it's still water that we're looking at. It's just that the environment of the water is affected by the deoxyhemoglobin because it's paramagnetic. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that it's got both an extravascular and an intravascular component. So the way I've been talking about it is the inside of the vessel is magnetized slightly differently because the deoxyhemoglobin, it affects, creates gradients around it. And that's an important contribution of the signal. But within the blood itself, it's a much more complicated sort of picture of magnetic field variation because you've got the red cells where the deoxyhemoglobin is and the space around them. So it turns out that the blood itself is in fact much more sensitive, the signal from blood is much more sensitive to these changes in deoxyhemoglobin. So even though the amount of blood is small, it actually, at 1.5 T, is probably a larger contribution to the signal change. In other words, you've got blood, which is there maybe at a level of 2-3% of the signal is actually coming from blood. But that signal is changing by 50% with activation, whereas the surrounding tissue that's 98% of the signal is changing by 1%. So it kind of works out to be similar values at lower fields. At higher fields, the blood signal tends to go down lower and lower, and you're getting more of the extravascular effect. Now, before we come back, let me show you now the way that we actually measure blood flow. So most of what's done in fMRI is looking at the change in oxygenation and those signals, and that's what's being mapped. But there's another technique, which is newer, which is called arterial spin labeling, which lets us actually measure blood flow directly with MR. And it's a very simple idea. It's related to the PET ideas of having a label that you inject and let go in, except we don't do any injections. We actually create the label with the MR scanner by inverting the magnetization of the arterial blood in a region below where we want to look. So imagine that we want to look at this slice. We apply a 180-degree inversion pulse to a large block of tissue just below that slice, the idea being that we're going to invert all of the water. So the magnetization of the water is coming in fully relaxed, and we tip it over. We then wait for that magnetization to be delivered into the tissue up here and make an image of that slice. Then we do the whole thing again, except we don't invert that magnetization, and again make an image of that slice. So if we do that carefully, all the spins that are sitting in that slice will give exactly the same signal in the two images, and so we can subtract them and get rid of them. But the blood is coming in inverted in one case and relaxed in the other case. So when we subtract those two signals, we get a signal due just to the blood. So it's a very direct way of measuring how much blood is being delivered. And since it doesn't actually involve an injection, we can keep doing this over and over. So we can do this 50 times if we need to average to get a good signal. And we do need to average because the difference between in the amount of blood that's actually delivered in the sort of 1 to 1.5 seconds that we have to work in there is very small. It's only about 1% of the tissue signal. So we're faced with a situation we want to subtract out 99% of the signal that's coming from that slice and leave just the signal of the blood, which is small. But what we're fighting there is that T1 relaxation time. We've inverted the magnetization of the blood. If we wait several seconds, it'll relax back. So if you think of it as our tag, our bolus of tagged stuff is related to the difference in magnetization between the fully relaxed during the control experiment and how much of that magnetization is still inverted in the other one. So we don't have too much time to work in. So it's about a minute. Sorry, a second. 1 second. So we typically might do an image where we average 50 times or 30 times, something like that, to get a good signal. But the nice thing about it is basically the difference of these two images is essentially proportional to the local flow. To the local blood flow. So we take the control image where there's no inversion and the tag image where there is. In practice, it's tricky because there's a lot of things that can make sort of systematic differences in the signal in a slice on the order of 1%, so comparable to the signal that we're trying to measure. So there's a lot of care that has to go into dealing with those. But the basic idea is relatively simple. And it allows you to get very good images. So they're EPI images, so they're coarser resolution than the other images, but these are differences with a couple of different techniques just showing the similarity of the responses that you can get. Now, one of the tricky things that you can do with this is you can also use it for an activation experiment. So the experiment that we're doing is we alternate between tag images and control images. So it's tag, we tag the blood, and the control where you don't tag it. So you go tag, control, every couple seconds you collect an image like that. And you do that for several minutes. And so during that time period, you have a subject perform some task like finger tapping again. So it's a very simple one to do in the experiment, and it gives a very good activation like that. The interesting thing that you can do is you can measure both the bold change and the flow change simultaneously with the same data. So by alternating between tag and control, we can essentially take that time series that we get and construct two different time series. One which is a flow time series by taking effectively pairwise differences, you know, tag minus control, tag minus control, tag minus control. And a second, which is eliminating the flow change, but still sensitive to the bold change by averaging the pair. So tag plus control, tag plus control. So you get two independent time series out of this, which are one related to flow and one related to bold. And you can see interesting things when you start to map these things. You can treat them as separate data sets even and show where they are strongly mapped. So here's a case where the white line is the sulcus that's lying there. And you can see what this looks like in this case is that the flow activation is on either side of the central sulcus, which is what we'd expect. It's both a sensory and a motor area there. We'd expect both to be lit up. Whereas the bold change seems to be more in the sulcus itself. Over here, there's even a larger shift. The centroid of activity in the bold is out here, whereas the flow is over here. And that's getting to be a substantial shift. That's probably getting close to a centimeter in there. So what's happening here is most likely that what we're seeing with a lot of the bold changes is draining veins. So imagine you've got activity in a certain area. It changes the level of oxygenation of the blood there. But that venous blood moves further downstream, collects up in a vein that's maybe several millimeters displaced from that site. And that site is where the vein is where the biggest change in deoxyhemoglobin is. So that's where we see the bold effect. We think that this is a better mapping, a more accurate mapping, because it's measuring the delivery of blood to the capillary bed. But it is certainly one of the problems with interpreting the bold signal is that it is, because it's measuring blood and because it's sensitive to deoxyhemoglobin, it is potentially very sensitive to this draining vein phenomenon, so displaced localization. The other thing that's interesting that comes out of this kind of combined data set is that you can look at the time course in a region. So this here's now the basic images. Here's the flow image that looks like that. First of all, one thing, if you simply subtract the on from the off, when they were tapping, when they weren't tapping. If you look at bold images, you tend to get things that look like this, where you tend to have, as I mentioned earlier, you tend to get a lot of junk around there, where you get sort of random things. It's probably some vessels, it may be some motion associated with the task. It's certainly bad if the subject is tipping their head when they if you tap your fingers like this and then rest, and then tap your fingers like this, there's going to be a significant signal change in a lot of voxels due just to that motion that happened to be correlated with the stimulus. So you tend to get a lot of things around here, as well as the actual activated areas there. And by applying different statistical tests to this, you can eliminate a lot of that other stuff and leave just those spots there. It's interesting with looking at the ASL change, it's a very clean subtraction. And the reason is that the ASL signal is constantly subtracting. You're going tag, control, tag, control, tag, control, and subtracting those. So any kind of slow variations in things, even motion correlated with the stimulus, you're tending to subtract out. And so you get a much cleaner baseline from that. So anyway, that's showing the activations that there's some potential for this kind of a technique that may be better in some applications than bold, even though it's intrinsically an even weaker signal change. In other words, the bold signal change is maybe a few percent, the flow is maybe 1%. So the actual signal that's being measured is weaker, but maybe we're more robust under some circumstances. The other interesting thing that we find is if we take a region and just average the signal there and look at the time course, what we see is that for the bold change, there's often a significant undershoot after the stimulus. Stimulus ends, the signal comes down below and comes back up. And that can last 30 seconds, even 40 seconds sometimes. We don't see much of an undershoot in the flow change. There's perhaps a little bit there, but it's much, much less than in the bold. We can do this with stimuli of different duration and measure nice, robust responses. This is looking at stimuli that were 2, 6, or 18 seconds long. And you can see you get reasonable responses. The blood flow responds very promptly to, well, it's delayed, but it doesn't take much of a stimulus to get a blood flow response. So we can measure both flow and bold responses. Now, what I'd like to talk about in the last part of this is more the physiology. So any questions on the MR techniques? That was more kind of just going through the different techniques, how they work, the bold techniques and that kind of thing. If it comes up, go ahead and ask. But basically, what I'd like to spend the rest of the time on is more the physiology. Because what we've got with fMRI is this interesting phenomenon that the oxygen metabolism does not go up as much as the blood flow. And that is the basis of the change in the oxygen extraction fraction, and so the change in the deoxyhemoglobin. If the oxygen metabolism went up by the same fraction as the blood flow, there would be no change in the oxygen extraction and no bold effect. So the presence of this effect is very critical for understanding what's going on. In other words, if that really is an uncoupling of flow and oxygen metabolism, which was what the original interpretation of Fox and Rakow was, then we're kind of in a bad situation because we don't really know how to interpret what we're seeing with the bold effect. In other words, you could imagine situations where there's neural activity, there's a blood flow change, but the oxygen metabolism change is the same, and so it would be quiet as far as the bold imaging was concerned. It would show up on the ASL imaging, but so far we haven't seen such things. We haven't seen any examples of that. So the data, certainly from the many bold experiments that are done, suggests that this is a regular phenomenon, that oxygen metabolism always goes up less than blood flow, so that we always see this change in blood oxygenation. But understanding this is a complicated thing. And this is in part due to what I said earlier about the fact that this bold response is not a simple physiological measurement. It depends on how much the oxygen metabolism changes, how much the blood flow changes, and how much the blood volume change is. All these, in turn, depend in some way on what the neural activity was, and the neural activity is in some way related to the stimulus. So it's this long, kind of complicated chain. And with human studies, typically we have no measure of this. We're applying the stimulus here and measuring this out here. So there's a lot that can happen in there. There's certainly some nonlinear effects that have been found, and those affect the design of experiments and that kind of thing. But we'd ultimately like to be able to, really complete this chain and understand what's going on. The ability to measure blood flow, I think it was one step further, closer to that, is getting down here. And just recently, I think David alluded to it, 2 weeks ago, there was a paper by Logothetis in Nature which is the first step in really making a direct measurement of that and a direct measurement of that and trying to see how they relate. So it's we're starting to get there, but basically this whole picture, we have no real quantitative understanding of how this all works. I'll try to give you some idea of some of the ways we've been trying to model it, and but it's a lot of it's speculation. So if we want to try to understand this bold human dynamic response, first of all, we have to look at what we think we're measuring. What we think is going on is, so this is just an example of measuring in the same region, the blood flow change, which is in yellow, measure with ASL, and the bold change. So again, showing they track pretty well during the stimulus itself. This was a stimulus right through here. But there is this post undershoot on the other end for the bold signal. So what we're, the basic modeling, you know, the quantitation that we can try to do is that the signal change is related to the total amount of deoxyhemoglobin that's present. Okay, so if this is normalized to its value at rest, then if this is 1, there's no signal change. If this goes up, the signal goes down. If this goes down, the signal goes up. Okay, so it's a little more complicated than that because of this intravascular versus extravascular contributions, but it's kind of basically looking like that. And so the fundamental ambiguity that we have to deal with is that this total deoxyhemoglobin depends on the extraction of oxygen, E, and how that changes, but also on the volume. In this case, we're thinking of the venous volume, because that's where the changes in deoxyhemoglobin are. So if the venous volume went up, even at the same level of oxygen extraction, that still is more deoxyhemoglobin present, and so it should affect the signal. The problem is that these two things are very difficult to unravel, and this actually gets at what David was talking about, the initial dip in the experiments of Grünwald and colleagues, is that it's a fundamental difficulty if you're only looking at deoxyhemoglobin and oxyhemoglobin, separating those things out. So, one of the interesting things you can do by trying to model the bold effect is actually try to measure how much of an oxygen metabolism change there is using MR techniques. And the idea with this is that if you could make some assumptions about how much the volume changes, if you assume that it changes by a certain fraction as the flow changes, you can then look at what the bold signal would be for different levels of change in oxygen metabolism. So what this is really, this N up here, is really delta CBF over resting CBF. In other words, the fractional change in CBF compared to the fractional change in oxygen metabolism. So, for example, if this goes up 30%, but this only goes up 5%, that ratio would be 6. So what's been measured with various PET studies is typically something like 3 to 6 for that ratio. But the interesting thing is that the curves of what the bold signal should look like vary with that. If the more the oxygen metabolism goes up, the lower this N, the weaker the bold signal is for the same amount of flow change. So the trick you can do with this is if you can measure both the flow change and the bold change, you can actually try to calibrate the bold change and thereby try to get at how much of an oxygen metabolism change there is by depending on which one of these curves you fall on. So the idea looks something like this. You can imagine if you were to plot the CBF change versus the bold change, you would have these contours of constant values of CMRO2. So this is a 10% increase, this one's a 20% increase. The trick is that you have to somehow calibrate. You have to somehow find what these are. And the way that that's been done is to use CO2. So if you breathe CO2, there really is an uncoupling of flow and oxygen metabolism because blood flow goes up a lot and oxygen metabolism doesn't change. At least that's what the experimental data supports. Why, I don't know. But the brain blood flow is very sensitive to the CO2. So if you do an experiment where you have a subject breathe CO2 and at the same time measure the flow change and measure the bold change, because there will be the flow is going up and oxygen metabolism isn't, so there will be a bold change as well. You can construct this calibration curve. Then you can look at that same part of the brain in an activation experiment and plot out how it falls in this plane of flow versus bold. Again, both measuring both. And from that, conclude what the change in oxygen metabolism is. So this was a very nice experiment done by Rick Hogue at Montreal at the time. showing under stimulation in humans, visual stimulations of various levels of contrast to get different levels of blood flow change and different levels of bulb change. And you can, from that, construct a nice curve of CBF change versus CMR2 change, showing a very nice regular graded response, but with the flow change significantly larger than the CMR2 change. So in this case, it's about twice as large. So it seems to me that there's good evidence that there is that CMR2, first of all, does increase with activity, as shown by this. It seems to increase in a very regular way with blood flow, although to a lower extent. So in the early days of BOLD, it was typical to assume that there was no change in CMR2. We can't do that anymore. It's clearly changing. So the idea of a complete uncoupling, I don't think, is workable anymore. So let me describe some of the ideas that we've been kind of working on to kind of explain a little more quantitatively what's going on. The first is to try to explain the basic observation that blood flow goes up more than oxygen metabolism is a model that we call the oxygen limitation model, which is essentially a reworking of the observations, if you like, but it's saying that it's actually necessary for the extraction of oxygen to go down with activation in order to support a larger CMR2. And because of that, then, you need to have a larger blood flow change than oxygen metabolism change. The second thing that's I want to talk about is that dip at the end, the post-stimulus undershoot at the end of that's so pronounced in the BOLD signal. We think it's probably a blood volume change that's slow to recover. So blood volume goes up with increased flow, but is then slow to come back down. And if the blood volume is elevated, even if the oxygenation of the blood has gone back down to normal, there'll be more deoxyhemoglobin. So the signal should go down. One of the things David mentioned was the initial dip, which is been seen with optical studies and with fMRI at sometimes. And that is probably, again, a sort of temporal variation between these different physiological quantities that are happening at the same time, but possibly with slightly different time constants. The other important thing for design of experiments is that all these steps are potentially nonlinear, from the stimulus to the neural activity to the blood flow to the BOLD change. And that actually has an important effect on the design of fMRI experiments, because we typically don't measure the response to one stimulus. We have to average. And if those are close together, you have to worry about the overlap of responses and things like that. So let me talk mainly about why it might be that we need to have a decrease in oxygen extraction in order to increase oxygen metabolic rate. It seems very paradoxical. The basic idea, of course, is that you can always write the metabolic rate of oxygen as the product of the arterial concentration times the flow times the extraction. So flow times concentration is telling you how much is being delivered, and the extraction fraction times that tells you how much is being taken out. And the basic argument is that there's evidence now for two things. First, that oxygen delivery at rest is actually limited, in that even though a typical extraction fraction is like 40% in the brain, however, it looks like something like 50% of the oxygen never even gets out of the capillary. So it's not really available for metabolism at all. And nearly all of the oxygen that does get out is metabolized. So you could think of it as it appears that the brain is at rest, even running kind of on the edge in terms of oxygen, using up all the oxygen that gets in, but there is a limitation to how much oxygen actually gets out of the capillary. The second is that when you increase flow, second effect is that when you increase flow, there does not appear to be any capillary recruitment. This has been controversial in the literature, and if you go back 15 years, there's a lot of papers saying that there is capillary recruitment. And the way to think about this is there's kind of two extremes of how you could increase flow. The first is the simple one: you make the blood move faster through the vessels. The second is that at rest you have capillaries that are just closed down. They're not getting any flow, and so then you open them up, and that's called capillary recruitment. That's thought to happen in muscles a lot, and it was thought to happen in the brain for a long time. But there consensus now is definitely leaning much more toward the idea that all the capillaries are open. There's no closing of capillaries that are then open with activity. The problem then is that if there's no capillary recruitment, then your only choice for increasing blood flow is to move the blood faster. So this combination of things, that you have limited oxygen delivery at rest, plus moving the blood faster, is what leads to the extraction having to go down. You can think of it as blood is moving down the capillary, and it's got a certain transit time to get through. During that transit time, there's a certain probability that an oxygen molecule will be able to get out. If that's not 100%, in other words, that it easily gets out, it's more like 50%, then making that transit time shorter is going to have to decrease that probability. It's going to have to be an even lower probability that it can get out and become available for metabolism. So because of that, that probability is related to the extraction fraction, and so that extraction fraction must go down. So if this quantity goes down necessarily with increased flow, then you have to increase this one by a lot so that the fact that that's decreasing doesn't offset it too much, and you get a smaller increase in oxygen metabolism. In other words, this is always going to be equal to something that has to go down and something that's going up. So F has to go up a lot more. Now that's kind of a dynamic view of it, of how much can be extracted and that kind of thing. You can also look at it from a more static point of view of looking at diffusion down a gradient. Nice physical process. And so the gradient that we've got here is at one side we have the capillary with oxygen, a particular PO2 of oxygen in here, driving a flux into the rest of the tissue and ultimately into the mitochondria down here. If the PO2 in the mitochondria is very low, and it probably is, although there aren't good measurements of that, then you have a diffusion down a gradient. You have got one value of concentration here and another one down here that's very near zero. In order to increase that diffusion gradient, you can't shorten the distance because there's no capillary recruitment. So the only thing you can do, and you can't lower this much, so the only thing you can do is try to raise this. But to raise the capillary plasma PO2, you can't raise the arterial value because that's fixed. So the only thing you can do is raise the venous value. But the only way you can raise the venous value is if you take less oxygen out, if you actually reduce the extraction fraction. Another way of looking at it is like this. If you imagine plotting the hemoglobin saturation versus PO2, then we start off on the arterial side with it fully saturated, and on the venous side it's down about 40% has been removed. So the venous PO2 is corresponding to a value like that, around, what does that look like, 35 maybe. If you want to increase that venous PO2, you have to move it this way, which moves you up to here, which moves you over there, which is a smaller extraction fraction then. So in other words, reducing the extraction fraction is a way of beefing up the oxygen content of the capillary to drive a greater flux into the tissue. But again, you're stuck with that thing that to satisfy that flux down that gradient, the product of the extraction fraction, the flow, has to equal the increased oxygen metabolic rate. So the thing that's kind of wrong with this picture is that it's suggesting that the oxygen content in the tissue, in the mitochondria, is near zero. And we know that that's not the case because you can look at cytochrome oxidase, at the last step of the electron transfer chain where the electrons are moving down and they get grabbed by the oxygen. You can look at the redox state of that site and see whether electrons are tending to pile up there because there's not enough oxygen. It doesn't look like they are. What data there is suggests that there's plenty of oxygen to do that. So we need another way of looking at this. We've already got one, so the first one describes this kinetic one, you know, thinking of it kind of the way we'd think of a tracer going in and coming out and its effect, the relation between CMR2 and the flow and the extraction fraction. We have diffusion down a capillary diffusion down a gradient would look something like this. But we also need to consider then that at some point inside this cell, we have CMR2 is related to the actual mitochondrial concentration of oxygen. And if we think of it as being a form like this, it's a Michaelis-Menten sort of kinetics, so that there's a Km, which describes the concentration at which this would start to become limiting. So if Cm is much greater than Km, this metabolic rate is independent of the amount of oxygen. And in a way, that's what you'd want. You don't want the oxygen metabolic rate to be limited by oxygen. You want it to be driven by the need for metabolizing things and generating ATP and that kind of stuff. So you'd want to have Cm well above Km. It turns out, though, that Km is probably extremely low, less than a millimeter of mercury, compared to of partial pressure of oxygen, compared to something like 45 as the average pressure in the capillary, PO2, so average concentration. So much, much lower. So it suggests that maybe the picture is something like this, that you have mitochondria at a very low, what we've plotted here is PO2, at different stages of this diffusion chain that we've got, so from the capillary down to the mitochondria. So if we were to maintain this mitochondrial level well above Km, you can increase this gradient. So the CMR2 is then proportional to this gradient, the difference between the mitochondrial PO2 and the capillary PO2. You could increase it somewhat by lowering the mitochondrial oxygen down here. At some point, though, it'll start to become limiting for oxygen metabolism, which is probably not a good idea. If you instead were to say, what would be required to maintain that mitochondrial PO2 at a constant value by increasing flow and decreasing the extraction to raise the capillary level up like that? And if you... Well, let me come back to that. Actually, this is what I think might be what may be going on with the initial dip. But let me come back to that in a minute. If you were to plot out what's required then, so this is, if you want to maintain, if you assume that the Km is about 1 mmHg and you want to maintain it at 5, so you want to maintain the mitochondrial concentration of oxygen at 5 mmHg, so well above that, so that there's plenty there. And you calculate what kind of flow change is required given the change in extraction that would happen, you get about a 4-to-1 ratio of blood flow change to oxygen metabolism change is what would be supported. So it's kind of what's observed kind of fits with this picture that maybe what's going on is that the mitochondrial concentration is staying about the same, cytoplasm concentration is going up, and capillary concentration of oxygen is going up a lot. This has been one of the puzzling things, is that it seems as if you look simply at the, you stick an electrode in the tissue, you're not sampling mitochondria, you're probably sampling cytoplasm here. So you stick an oxygen electrode and you measure the PO2 level, that rises with activity. And that's been assumed to mean that oxygen is delivered in excess of what's needed. By this kind of a picture, it's not in excess of what's needed, it's what's necessary in order to maintain the mitochondrial level at a constant value. So it's a little tricky in how we interpret some of these measurements of things. But this also brings up an interesting thing, which is that it may not be that tissue PO2 is a good signal for regulating CBF at all. So one of the concerns is, what is it that CBF is doing? It changes by a lot with activation. What is it that's being regulated? And the simplest answer to that would be to say that it's regulating X at a constant value. And so if oxygen delivery is the thing, then you might say, okay, it's regulating oxygen content at a constant value. But that probably isn't a good design for how this should work. Because if by this picture you actually need to increase the PO2, you actually need to increase the concentration of oxygen in both the capillary and in the cytoplasm to increase the gradient flux down, then a simple feedback system isn't going to be enough. So in other words, you can imagine you could have a simple feedback system where if the PO2 goes down, the CBF goes up, the PO2 goes up, the CBF goes down. And that would be a good way of kind of regulating things in the face of fluctuating blood flow. If for whatever reason blood flow was fluctuating, then that would tend to restore it to a constant PO2 value. And so at a constant level of metabolic activity, that would work reasonably well. But it wouldn't work to increase the level of activity substantially, because to do that, you actually need to increase the PO2, and you don't want the feedback system to be trying to reduce CBF from that point. So for that reason, I don't actually think that PO2 is what's being is the direct signal for the regulation. And so it means that this picture is a little complicated, and because I'm trying to say that the reason blood flow increases a lot is to supply that oxygen, but the oxygen content of the tissue is not serving as the error signal that it's using to correct that. And I think that's one reason that it's rather hard to understand all of the changes in CBF in a simple way. And I think what we are probably going to have is multiple components that affect the CBF to really understand this in a quantitative way. Now, let me go back real quick here to the initial dip, because this has been something that you read about a lot. It's been very controversial. It started with Malone and Grinwald, actually with some earlier studies of Grinwald, where they, using an optical technique, optical reflectance technique, measured the concentration of deoxyhemoglobin and oxyhemoglobin. So this is deoxyhemoglobin, this is oxyhemoglobin. Now, the bold effect is due to this drop in deoxyhemoglobin. But what they saw was, with a brief stimulus here, an initial increase in deoxyhemoglobin followed by that decrease that looks like the bold effect. And in bold studies, that has also been seen. Here's a study from Menon with a four Tesla system showing an initial dip here corresponding to that initial rise up there. It's often called the initial dip, so the fMRI version of it is the one that takes precedence often, so even though it's an initial increase. Sometimes it's called the fast response, too. This has been highly controversial, mainly because not everybody sees it. So other people doing similar experiments to Grinwald have not found it, while others have. It seems to depend, there's been a lot of controversy about the exact corrections that you make for the path length of scattering photons in that technique. Even in MR, it has not been consistent. So a number of groups have tried to find it as well and don't see it. Other groups see it very regularly. So it's controversial in that sense that it's not easily reproducible. What makes it interesting, though, is that Grinwald originally, this Malone Grinwald, originally argued that this change was better localized than this one down here. So that if you used that to make a map, for example, looking at columnar structure in the brain, that mapping from this signal gave a much clearer picture of the columns than mapping from that signal. And the way they interpreted that was that what they're seeing here is an initial increase in the extraction of oxygen. So before the flow changes occurred, oxygen is being sucked out of the blood, basically. So oxygen metabolism goes up right away, pulls more oxygen out before the flow has had a chance to kick in and increase the delivery of oxygen. Once that happens, it comes in excess, if you like. It delivers much more than was needed and goes down here. So this technique has been used in fMRI. This initial dip has been used for mapping columnar structures. Again, finding that this was a better map, produced a more, better in the sense of a kind of a sharper distinction between the columns in the map made from this than from this out here. And the picture that Malone and Grinwald drew of this then was that they used the metaphor that it's that this is really watering the garden for the sake of one thirsty flower. The idea that the blood supply is only coarsely controlled. So even though it's this little column that's being activated, the blood flow is increased over a much wider region. So you get a big increase in blood flow, but the oxygen metabolism is only going up in that one little area. And so the net averaged oxygen metabolism change is small compared to the blood flow change. And that because of that coarse control of the blood flow, that's why the later signal, it does not give as clean a map as that early signal. So it's a hypothesis that has great implications for fMRI, because it's related to how good our spatial resolution is going to be, since ultimately it'll be the physiological control of blood flow that limits the resolution rather than the hardware. And if it's really very coarse, then that sets a limit that we may be not far from. But the fact is that I think it's much too strong an interpretation of what's going on. In part because there have been some nice demonstrations now that you could take not just this part here, the initial dip, but actually take the early part of this rising part, and use that as a mapping signal and get good columnar representations with that. You can also take arterial spin labeling measurements and get good representations of the columnar structure with that as well. So it's difficult to interpret because there's one of the things that I showed an example of was that the bold effect is often dominated by draining veins. And the longer you wait, the more time you have for the blood, for the deoxygenated blood to get out into the draining veins. So it's not surprising that if you look late, long after a signal, it's spread more into the veins, and so you get a not as precise a change. So that looking at the very beginning of the change should be good. The other thing that is still not clear about this, about what's actually going on at the beginning here, is that this does not look like a pure change in extraction fraction of oxygen. It looks like a combination, I should say, this in combination with this does not look like that. It looks like a combination of a volume change and an extraction change. So thinking, remembering back now, that the fundamental ambiguity we've got is that we can't, in looking just at deoxyhemoglobin, it's hard to tell the difference between volume changes on the venous side and extraction changes, because they both change the amount of deoxyhemoglobin. But if it was a pure extraction fraction change, then what we would expect to see is the deoxyhemoglobin going up and the oxyhemoglobin going down. In other words, if there's no volume change at all, that there's simply it's just the how much is oxygenated, how much is deoxygenated, at a total constant level of hemoglobin, this one should show a corresponding dip in that period compared to that one. But all the studies seem to show this, that it looks like when it is seen, this initial dip, which is really an increase, is in the deoxyhemoglobin only. The oxyhemoglobin has a very smooth change, doesn't show any kind of a dip. So I don't know what that means, but it seems to be the way that most of these things are seen. So what it suggests to me is that there's interesting dynamics going on in that first 2 seconds of stimulus, in that it may be that we've got oxygen metabolism changes going on and blood flow changes going on and associated blood volume changes with slightly different time constants. So it could be that the initial dip is something in this picture. Oops. That the initial dip is something like there is kind of a buffer here of oxygen availability, in that mitochondrial concentration is higher than what's needed down here. You could, in fact, increase this initially by having this drop down. If it drops down too much, it would actually become limiting for oxygen metabolism. But if it's a transient thing, by the time before that really has much of an effect, the blood flow kicks in and comes up. And so that could lead to, just from subtle shifts in the relative timings of how the blood flow change occurs and how the demand for oxygen metabolism occurs, could lead to a dip. It may even be related to what the resting level of oxygenation is in the tissue. If for example, all these initial dip studies, or most of the initial dip studies, are in animals. And so you always have to worry about how either the anesthesia is affecting it, if it's an anesthetized study, or how the gases that they're breathing has affected things. If you have them, for whatever reason, have an elevated blood flow, so for example, if there's a little more CO2 in their mixture, or the CO2 is not being cleared quite as effectively, so that it builds up a little bit, blood flow will increase and be delivering more oxygen, which would tend to raise this level here, perhaps giving a little more of a buffer that could be used right at the beginning. So the point I'm trying to make is that I think the initial dip is actually very interesting, in part because it is so variable. And I think that the variability is not due to technique problems in different labs, but a real physiological phenomenon. But it could be rather dependent on exactly how the animal is prepared and how these things happen. You can easily imagine that the time constant for the blood flow to come up is affected in some way by the anesthesia, whereas the oxygen metabolism demands are more local, in a sense, in terms of the actual need for ATP. By making subtle changes like that. So if you imagine that the flow change comes up a little delayed behind the metabolism change, you can get these kind of little divots like this, little increase in the oxygen extraction before it goes down. And then if there are manipulations in the actual state of things, you can adjust the height of that even a little bit. So I think that probably it's something like that that's going on with the initial dip. It'll be interesting if it can be confirmed that it's simple physiological manipulations like the amount of O2 that the animal's breathing or something like that that's affecting it. Anyway, if we take this picture of oxygen limitation it and plot it versus what's been measured, there's a lot of scatter in the data. There's a lot of points measured with different techniques, with PET, with MR, MR in rats versus humans. These points in particular don't fit very well on that curve, although these are not too bad, but it's a lot of scatter. It's quite possible that something else is going on at the lower extremes as you reduce flow below the resting level. Because flow is doing other things. It has to clear CO2 as well as deliver oxygen. It's not as hard to clear the CO2 as it is to deliver the oxygen, most likely, but it may be that something like that becomes important. But the interesting kind of picture that comes out of this is that the relationship between CMR2 and CBF and the extraction fraction is a little counterintuitive, in the sense that this is normalized CBF over here, and then this is either plotting the extraction fraction as the dashed line or the normalized CMR2 as the solid line. So at rest, each has a value of 1. So with increased flow, we have a picture of oxygen metabolism also increasing, but at a slower rate, so that the extraction fraction drops. The extraction fraction with lower activity, if CBF goes down, actually goes up. And there's some evidence for this. It's seen in some disorders. So there's a phenomenon called cross-cerebellar diaschesis, where there's parts of the brain which are receiving inputs from an area where subjects have stroke. So it's no longer getting any the level of activity in that functional area still is down from what it should be. And that area shows an increased oxygen extraction fraction. So it corresponds to the idea that decreasing your activity actually increases the oxygen extraction. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this kind of a picture is that it does look like it might give some protection. So if you imagine having a stroke where your blood flow is reduced by a substantial amount, you could reduce the blood flow by a factor of 2, down to 50%, and still maintain about 80% of the oxygen metabolic rate. So in a way, it gives a little protection to the tissue in terms of reduced flows. It also may be, this is also speculative, it's kind of along the lines of something Mark Raichel suggested, which is that it may be that the extraction fraction is kind of an interesting thing, and that it may actually be a way of distinguishing between an activation and a deactivation. So when we do a bold experiment, we typically, a simple design is like a block design that has on periods and off periods. And if you see a region that's activated, it means it has more activity in the on period than the off period. If you find one that's deactivated, usually people just think of it as they've kind of done a poor job of choosing their control task, that it's actually more activated in the control task than in the other. And so there's nothing absolute about it in most experiments. But it's conceivable that there is something absolute, that during development, the brain, different regions of the brain develop a vascular supply to supply the needed oxygen, needed glucose, at an oxygen extraction fraction of about 40%. Because if you look at the human brain and you measure the extraction fraction, it's very uniform. It's always about 40% at rest, whatever rest is. So you can imagine that is kind of a convenient set point, that 40% is not too high and not too low. It allows some flexibility, and that so different regions of the brain adjust so that a normal level of activity it requires a 40% extraction. If that's the case, then if we could measure E, then a raised extraction would correspond to a deactivation of that region below that set point, and a decrease in E would be an activation above that set point. It's pure speculation, but it's an interesting thing to think about. Unfortunately, we can't measure E very easily with MR. We can measure flow and we can measure the Bold effect, but we can't really measure E. So let me real quick talk about the undershoot. So here's some data from Joe Mandeville showing where he measured both blood flow, blood volume, and the Bold effect. And the blood volume is measured with a contrast agent that's put in. You put it into the blood. It's basically an iron compound, and it affects the local signal in proportion to how much is there. So it's a measure of blood volume. And what he found was that the Bold signal in yellow here shows a nice pronounced undershoot at the end of the stimulus over here. And during that period, the blood volume, however, is slow to come back down. So it's slow to come up and slow to come back down. Now, in a way, that's kind of puzzling, because we think of the blood volume changes as being related to the blood flow change. How do you change blood flow through vessels? You dilate the arterioles, increase the volume in order to decrease the resistance, and the flow goes through faster. Now, the pressure, arterial pressure stays the same. You're decreasing the resistance in order to get a faster flow. So you would expect that if you were thinking of blood volume changes as being resistance changes, that they should, if anything, precede the blood flow changes, but should certainly go with them. But the interesting thing that happens is that is what happens on the arterial side. But the arterioles are a fairly small volume fraction. So that dilation of the arterioles is probably not a big component of the total volume change. And what may be happening is that, here we go. So what happens, you can imagine happening, is that as you increase the pressure, as you cross the arterioles here, you decrease the pressure drop, you decrease the resistance there, so it decreases the pressure drop. So the pressure increases here, that means the pressure is going to increase here as well. It's going to increase across all the lower phases of the tree. The veins are the most distensible of the vessels, and so a slight change in the pressure may lead to an increase in the volume of the veins. But it's sort of a passive reaction to the change in flow, in that the veins are not much resistance, so changing them doesn't have much effect on the overall flow. The resistance is all up here in the arterioles, you know, arterioles and the capillaries. So by decreasing the resistance here, you tend to increase the pressure all the way down, and the veins kind of swell in response, passively. And with this picture, you can make this a little more quantitative. We just to try to see how this might work, we propose to model this as a volume down here, which is in fact with a flow out that depends on the volume down here. In other words, like a balloon. Imagine blowing up a balloon, and then the outflow from that balloon depends on the pressure that you created inside. So if you start increasing the pressure down here, it fills up until its volume has increased enough that it's now ejecting enough out this side, so that you again have the same outflow as inflow. So what this means is that the picture of flow is that the inflow here would increase first, outflow might increase much more slowly with volume increasing. So we have to have a mass balance of the amount coming in and going out. And that could lead to some dynamics. And it turns out if you take this and then just try to calculate two dynamical quantities, just the total deoxyhemoglobin and the blood volume, you can write equations for that which are just related to mass balance. You're just balancing how much deoxyhemoglobin is coming in versus how much is going out, and whatever the difference is must be how much is there, or volume itself. And by putting in this kind of an extraction fraction that's related to flow, in other words, like I've been talking about with assuming that oxygen metabolism is coupled to flow, you can get a set of equations that let you calculate what you would expect to see as a bold signal out of that by taking account that, in other words, you're modeling the two dynamic variables, the deoxyhemoglobin and the volume, which are the ones that relate to the signal that you're measuring. And if the trick is, how do you model what the outflow is? Now, the way that we've put it in here is there's some experimental data showing that if you do a steady state change, you increase the blood flow, let it settle, measure the blood volume, increase the blood flow, measure the volume again, you can get a parallel relationship between the flow and the volume, where the relationship, this alpha, is about 0.4, so that the volume change is smaller than the flow change, but it changes with the flow. That seems to be the steady state situation, but what appears from the data is that there's a dynamic period when that steady state relationship does not hold. And so we experimented here by just putting in a simple kind of viscoelastic sort of term here, in which the actual rate of change of the flow is related not only to the volume but to the rate of change of the volume. And it's in such a way that it tends to resist fast changes. So you try to inflate it real fast and it resists, or you try to deflate it, and it resists. So at a steady state, this term goes away, and so it obeys that steady state relationship that experiment has shown. So if we put in different values of that time constant, that viscous time constant there, we can make curves that look like this, that if flow in is a very simple curve that looks like that. So there's actually two curves on top of each other there. So identical flow curve, but then different biomechanical models, if you like, for the venous structures. If that tau is zero, so there is no viscoelastic term, then if you plot outflow versus volume, it has a nice simple structure. If you plot, if on the other hand that's equal to 20, you get a hysteresis effect here, that the flow, the relationship is different on the way up than on the way down. And what that leads to is a volume that lags behind the flow change, and then it lags behind again. As it comes back down, it comes down more slowly, and gives a picture of a bold signal that looks, you know, has a nice pronounced undershoot on the other side, even though there's none in the flow. So if you can, you know, try to fit it to that data that I showed earlier of the two. But the basic picture then is one in which you have basically coupled oxygen metabolism and blood flow here, that they tend to go up together but by different amounts. You have blood volume, which comes up more slowly. In this example, it happens to come to the same level, but it need not do that. But then comes down more slowly as well. Actually, this one comes up at the same rate and comes down more slowly. So that the deoxyhemoglobin actually does a little flip-flop here, that it initially is low and then comes high over here at the end, giving a bold signal that has a pronounced dip in it. So it just kind of illustrates that there's a lot in the bold signal. You know, there's a lot in the dynamics that we don't fully understand. We can sort of speculate about things like this, about how other components are going on at the same time. But it emphasizes again that it's a kind of a complicated end result of many things. And just to end up with, it's this picture that we're trying to understand, as I mentioned earlier, from a stimulus to neural activity to blood flow to a bold response. And just briefly, one of the things that we've certainly found is that this is rather nonlinear going through here, and that nonlinearity could come in several places. One place that we know it comes in is that the relationship between blood flow and the bold response is not linear. Remember, I showed those curves actually a while back that showed for different flows what the bold response would be, and they all tend to curve over. And in fact, they have to curve over, because think about it. What's happening here is that you're seeing a decrease in the amount of deoxyhemoglobin, and that's what raises the signal level. Suppose the flow increased by an infinite amount. The deoxyhemoglobin can do nothing except go to zero. So it's got to have a ceiling on it. It's got to have a plateau effect. And that's a nonlinearity. So it means that a signal, a flow response that is partway up that curve is going to appear too strong with a later one that's stronger than that. So for example, one of the ways we can look at linearity in a simple way is simply to do stimuli of different durations and see if the response to a short stimulus can predict the response to a long stimulus. And what many studies have found is that it doesn't do very well. And what always seems to be the case is that the response to a short stimulus seems stronger than it should. So that if you take that response and replicate it many times to predict the response to a longer stimulus, you over-predict what it's going to look like. So that type of unfortunately, that type of nonlinearity can come in a couple of ways along this chain. So one way is like this. So if a short stimulus only produces this much of a flow change, whereas a longer stimulus produces a larger flow change, then you're effectively extrapolating up on a straight line from zero through that. And if this is curving over, that'll tend to give you that sort of overprediction. But you also can get that kind of overprediction in a very simple way from the way the neural activity responds to a stimulus. So if you do a visual stimulus that looks like that, the neural activity may very likely look like that, you know, with an initial spike and then some adaptation that comes down. That also has the same effect in that a short stimulus is going to get a stronger response than it seems like it should if you only look at the longer ones. So those sorts of effects are still active areas of exploration. And I thought I'd just close with showing some of the data from Logothetis' paper, because one of the questions is that David kind of alluded to earlier is, we aren't even sure what we mean by neural activity here. You know, there's different ways you could define that. You could define that as neurotransmitter recycling. You could define it in terms of the postsynaptic potentials. You could define it in terms of the action potentials that are being produced in a region. So all of those in some way must take some energy, but the details of how that energy breaks down is not really very well understood. The current thinking is that it is more, what Logothetis was trying to show here is, I don't know if you can see this very well either, he shows a very light shade of color. What's plotted here are responses to three different stimuli of different duration. So one is, 24 seconds long, 12 and 4, looks like, seconds long. So these are the stimuli here, from here to here, and from here to here. And what the curves are showing is the bold response is almost invisible. It's in this very light, if you can see it at all, this was unfortunately the color you used. Here's a bold response, and here's a bold response, and up there, the response that comes out like that. He also then measured electrophysiology recordings. So to look at both the the local field potential, as well as something related. This is spiking density frequency. Basically trying to measure, and the multiple unit number is essentially supposed to be a measure of the spiking rate. And what he found was that these sorts of measures, which are basically from the high frequency components of the recording, tended to come up and come down very quickly and not be extended. So even though the stimulus itself was extended, they ended pretty abruptly. Whereas the local field potential showed more of a curve that comes up and has a sustained level during the stimulus. And so they found a better correlation between the local field potential and the bold signal. So the implication of that is that if the local field potential is more of a representation, more a reflection of the synaptic activity. So it's more a reflection of the inputs to the region rather than the outputs. If we think of the spiking activity as the output, the bold signal seems to correlate more with the inputs to the region. But again, this is a correlation. You know, this is what's really needed here is a good solid theory of the energy metabolism, the energy that's required for these different phases, and how that might be related to the blood flow changes, what the mechanisms are that connect that neural activity change to the blood flow change, and specifically why the blood flow change then is so large. Those are kind of all levels of that question are not, don't have a good answer at this point. So despite the fact that the bold effect seems to be incredibly reliable and very sensitive for measuring activation, we still don't really have a quantitative picture of how we get from the neural activity to that bold effect. And I think I should probably end there. So questions? So there's lots of work for physicists. I should mention also that one of the other things that makes this complicated is it's not at all clear even what the glucose metabolism is doing, because it does not appear that the blood flow change is necessary for the glucose metabolism change to occur. So for a couple of reasons, glucose is actually delivered in excess of what's needed. So about half the glucose that actually leaves the capillary and gets into the tissue isn't metabolized at all, just diffuses back out and is cleared away on the venous side, unmetabolized. So in principle, you could increase your glucose metabolic rate without increasing blood flow at all. And in fact, that has been shown to happen if you suppress the nitric oxide synthase, which is, as you all know, NO is in some way closely related to dilating the vessels. Again, there's not a good quantitative model for how that works, but in terms of relating like the vessel dilation to concentration of NO or things like that. But if you suppress that, you can suppress the blood flow change with activation. It doesn't change the glucose metabolism change. So the glucose metabolism seems to be able to increase perfectly well without changing the flow. So it doesn't look like that's required. It may be that, and it also looks like the glucose metabolism is, from the PET studies, is increasing by a larger amount than the oxygen metabolism change. If that's really true, there should be lactate being produced. And that has been shown early on in visual stimulation studies that there was lactate produced because the glucose metabolism was faster than the oxygen metabolism, increased faster. But you have to wonder if that's really going on all the time, that there should be more lactate sort of produced regularly by the brain, and there doesn't seem to be. So it's a puzzle even on the glucose side how that fits in. Well, thank you. It's 5:00.